Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide daily over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on looking at economic reality right after this. You know, when the federal income tax was launched back in 1913, the tax was levied only on the super wealthy, the richest one-half of 1% of our population, with a top tax rate of only 7%. Today, of course, the fears of those early opponents of this tax have been more than fully realized. By the time Herbert Hoover's term expired, the top tax rate had jumped to 60%. And by the time Franklin D. Roosevelt was done, the top tax rate was over 90%. And the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. And in 1913, the average family had to work until January 30th to earn enough to satisfy the tax man at every level. This year, the average American family had to work all the way through May 12th in order to earn enough to pay their federal, state, and local tax bills. Now, when we compare this to the plight of medieval serfs, says economist Daniel J. Mitchell, they only had to give the lord of the manor a third of their output and they were considered slaves. Now, what does that make us then today? This income tax and Social Security tax violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant, including our English common law. The income tax and Social Security tax are two criminal activities. The income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and Social Security tax is the eighth plank. That's why I contend that you owe it to yourself to at least ask the question, do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, while you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. Remember, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. All you have to do is call and ask for one. Our tax and status school is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, and just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. All right, we are taking a look now at economic reality through the eyes of the privateer. I'll tell you where you can get a copy. The Privateer is published in Queensland, Australia, published by William A.M. Buckler, and Post Office Box 2004, Noosa Heads, Queensland, 4567, Australia. I'll give you that number again. It's a little strange to us Yanks. It's William A.M. Buckler, B-U-C-K-L-E-R, Post Office Box 2004, Noosa Heads. That's N-O-O-S-A, one word, H-E-A-D-S, second word, Queensland, Australia. And put a 4567 in there. They're also online. You can go to www.the-privateer.com. It's easy enough. www.the-privateer.com. Their email address is capt@the-privateer.com. lawhour.com. And if you want to call them on the telephone, the number is 617-5471-1960. That's 617-5471-1960. It's called The Privateer. We're looking here at volume, let's see, the 2009 volume number 629. You're looking for number 629, The Report on Economic Reality. All right, last time we were talking about this thing of the global countdown to bankruptcy rolls on. Now, this is part of a pre-programmed event. The world is being directed into world national bankruptcy. All the nations of the world are headed to bankruptcy, and that's where we're going to come up with our solution. The solution to the problem is the New World Order and a one-world government with a one-world currency, a one-world money. So we're in the process of watching the money supply of the world being destroyed. The Chinese yuan will be destroyed. The Japanese yen is being destroyed. The American dollar is being destroyed. And it will create so much distress, so much chaos, anarchy. I suspect that we'll see World War III come out of this, but even if we don't, we're going to see a new world order, new world government. That's what they're aiming for. Now, how is that going to affect you? It's going to affect all of us, whether we like it or not. It's kind of like reading the book of Revelation, chapter 6. You know, here it comes. Bend over, get the grease out. Now, budget deficits and the burden of government. Remember last time we talked about, figuratively, it is as if the treasuries are trying to push the sky back up to where it was before, ignoring the real economic ground which has fallen out from under them. Well, if the private civil economy contracts to 70% of gross domestic product, and the government costs are unchanged, then the economic burden of government rises to 28.5%. In this situation, a real economy, which is 10% smaller, has to carry a government which is 3.5% larger. So if a government then rebels against this 10% fall in national GDP and tries to bring it back to its previous 100%, it must expand its own spending by that 10% of GDP to become 30% of the nation's GDP, since it is extremely politically unpalatable to raise taxes to that extent. The government then has to borrow money. Now, that may be obfuscated. You're sitting there with your eyes blinking and your mind is whirling and you're going, oh my God, what did he just say? Okay, let's just analyze this for a second. You can see that the economy is contracting. And as the economy contracts, then the tax revenues for the government contract. Now, none of us like this contraction. It's like you taking a 10% pay cut. You don't want to do that. So, if we're going to avoid this 10% pay cut, the government says, then the government has to get in here with borrowing. Now, if we're going to borrow, then we have to borrow more than that 10%, and we have to do that to offset the lower tax revenue that's coming in. And it's kind of like compounding. Now, Arnold Schwarzenegger, our governor out in California, is running through this very same problem. You see, when times were good and the economy was expanding, tax revenues expanded. So instead of saving some money for a rainy day, they spent it all. They just increased their spending so that they could spend it all. All right. Now, we've got a new standard of living. Now that we've increased our standard of living by spending it all, as the economy expanded 2%, 2%, 2%, 2% every year for several years, We got used to the idea that, well, our standard of living is now increased by 10, 15, 20%, whatever it happened to be. Now we're in recession, and so now it's contracting. But now the government says, well, we don't want it to contract. We don't want to go back to where we were 5, 10 years ago and live at that standard of living. We want to maintain our standard of living. So to do that, we have to borrow the money. But at the very same time, we've got a pay cut. That's what this is boiling down to. See, your tax revenues are now less than they were 10 years ago. Oh, my God. So now how are we going to maintain our standard of living? And that's the dilemma that they're out trying to solve in California. And indeed, that's the dilemma that everybody around the world is trying to solve. Now, the correct answer to this is you sit down, shut up, fold your hands, and let this thing sink to its least common denominator. That would occur in about 30 to 60 days. If you didn't add stimulus packages in and you weren't out here trying to borrow money, you just sat back and let the thing fall back to where it was at some point in the past, that's called bottom. But see, nobody wants to do that. So in order to avoid that, we're going to go through all these stimulus packages. We're going to borrow all this money and bankrupt ourselves, which is a worse outcome than if we were to just leave it alone. But we can't do that. We have to do something, don't we? We have to do something. And so we're out here busily doing something which is going to actually hasten the expiration, make it worse. That's the bottom line. Now, if the private civil economy, then, is contracting, the problem is that the internal gearing now stands at 30% government and 70% civil economy. That raises the government burden on the civil economy to 42.8%. Government borrowings have to be serviced, and the pretense of eventual repayment must be upheld. So the government's out here busily trying to borrow money. To go from a government burden of 25% to 42.8% can hardly be said to improve an economy. So what we're going to do here is we're going to go to our government and say, okay, we don't want to take a hit here, save us. So the government, which is now taking 25% of everything, is going to take 42.8%. I mean, that's where the numbers come out. So we're going to increase the size of government. Well, okay. Every place that that's been done in the past has proved to be economically unfeasible. And it brings these governments ultimately to economic collapse. Then we have to start over again at zero COD, which is a hell of a lot less palatable than taking a 10% hit, letting the thing go back to zero, and let's start over again. But hey, listen, everybody says we got to do something. And we all feel a lot better when government's out here doing something, even if what they're doing is the wrong thing to the wrong people at the wrong time for the wrong purpose, which is going to have a very bad or a very wrong outcome. But hey, we got to do something. Now, the global bank credit money deflation is now rolling at an annual rate of 22%, as stated in the BIS report. The real economic effect of this, though it will vary from country to country, is that the global price mechanism has to flex downwards to reconnect to the lower total stock of money. So, put another way, what we're doing is actually exacerbating our problem. We think that we're solving our problem with more and more bailouts, which in reality is having exactly the opposite effect. And that's exactly what happened in the 1930s. The stimulus that the government put into the economy had the exact opposite effect from what we thought it was going to do. Henry Morgenthau, who was the Secretary of the Treasury back in 1939, went to Congress and testified, and he said, everything that we've done from 1933 until today, 1939, in 6 years, has produced zero economic effect on the economy. So the Secretary of the Treasury, 6 years after the WPA and the CCC and packing the Supreme Court and doing all these thingies over here, you know, getting all this activity going, stirring up all this dust and hate and discontent, when it was all said and done, accomplished zero. Zero. That was his report in 1939. Now, today, when you go to public school, they say, oh, my God, it saved us from the Depression. It didn't do that at all. It had the exact opposite effect. It drug it out for 11 years, which is exactly what this is going to do. The ship is going to sink, but it isn't going to sink right now. It's going to sink in 11 years. Well, everybody says, well, that's better than sinking now. Well, okay. Okay, go ahead and do it. It would seem like to me that it would be a better course of action to get this thing over with right now, and let's get on with building another ship and get on with the real world, but I guess we want to try to save the Titanic. The ultimate end is you're going to lose it, and then you're not going to build a new ship to replace it, and you're going to be treading water in the cold water at that for a long time. If that's what you want to do, then you're on the right track. Now, when both monetary deflation and recession hit at the same time, here's what we get. If prices don't follow the monetary deflation down, the result is that many economic goods will not clear the market. Factories and businesses will close and mass unemployment will climb across the world. So worldwide, we are all stuck in two gigantic economic situations. There is a fast developing world recession and a global credit money system deflation working simultaneously. These two economic phenomena are, of course, acting on each other. In effect, they are intertwined. All major central banks are holding their official interest rate at or below 1% and engaging in direct money infusions into their banking and financial systems. On both counts, they are acting contrary to any possible real solution. They have negated the action of the money saver. Without a voluntary return of the monetary saver, there is no solution to this problem. The return of voluntary savings in the form of money requires two things. It requires real market interest rates which reward those who save. And even more importantly, it requires a better quality of money which can be relied upon to retain its purchasing power. So ultimately, that requires a sound money, gold money. The solution to the economic dilemma that we're in, boys and girls, is a return to gold and silver coin. Now, what do you think the chances of that happening are going to be? Let me tell you that it is exactly zero. I would say it's less than zero, but zero. And that's because the monetary authorities that are in power, in political power around the world, don't want gold and silver. They don't make any money on gold and silver. That would solve the problem. And we don't want to solve the problem. We want to create chaos and instability, so that in the crisis, we can come up with the solution. And the solution is a one-world government with a one-world currency. Okay, now that's what the powers that be want, and that's what they're going to give us. Now, for us little guys down here feeding on the bottom of the pond, that's not good news. We have to bear the burden of the unemployment and the chaos and the transition. We have to bear the burden of the shortages, which will be food shortages and gasoline shortages and tires and all these shortages that are coming up. The rationing. We'll have to be rationed, all these goods and services. And it's going to take a long time to do this. Now, the monetary authorities, that is Tim Gaither and President Obama and the Congress of the United States and working with the Federal Reserve and Ben Bernanke, and then working around the world with all the central banks and so on. This process is going to work its way out over the next 10 to 15 years. And it's going to be hell. It's going to be a real tough time. So get used to it, because that's where the real economic reality is located. Page 3. In reality, eating the cake means that it is no longer there. In basic logic, there is such a principle as irreversible logic. Modern economists and politicians simply do not understand this principle of logic and irreversible logic. It is the existence of the factory, the apple orchard, or any other productive entity which gives value to the money that it represents. It is not the other way around. Money does not give value to the apple orchard. It is the apple orchard that gives value to the money. Now that is an irreversible fact. It does not work in reverse. Remove the factory or the apple yard from reality and from the context of basic logic, and there is nothing there for the money to buy. What is the value of that sum of money when there is nothing there to buy with the money? Now, this simple example of basic logic has not stopped modern economists and politicians from standing in front of a television camera to proclaim that they have supplied immense sums of new capital to the monetary system. Well, what is this new capital? It is newly created credit money, treasury handouts, and subsidies of all descriptions. Okay, let's pause here and think about this for a second. We have a monetary contraction. And so the government says the solution to this is to print more money and give it to the banks to bail them out. Okay, now that we've done that, how many more tires does that put on the shelf? How many more sacks of wheat are there on the shelf than there were before we started the monetary expansion? And the answer is none. So now we have more money out there chasing fewer and fewer goods. And what is that going to do? Well, the people that have that money are going to go into the store and buy up those goods. But all of us unemployed people out here aren't working in our factories, and we're not picking apples, and we're not putting the goods back on the shelf. And that's what causes shortages. So the ultimate end of all of this monetary expansion is rapid inflation, called hyperinflation, and then the disappearance of all the goods from off the shelf. Now, boys and girls, those goods on the shelf are the things that you eat and wear and use every day. That's what constitutes your standard of living. And they are going to disappear very shortly. Then what are you going to do? That's the real economic reality. Then what are you going to do? All right, now take these claims of the provision of new capital literally. What they amount to in reality is someone rolling up with a truck filled with newly printed paper money or new credit money created in the account of an official lender, and then announcing to the adoring throng that we are all saved. I have brought new capital. Let there be new factories here. Well, the privateer hopes that none of our subscribers would be surprised in the slightest that 6 months later, that same politician or central banker is still yelling out his message while the fields around him are as empty as they were before. The plain and simple mistake that the politician has made in his mind is to put an equal sign between money and capital. There is no such equal sign. In plain physical reality, new capital, new factories, new orchards, or new anything else are made possible by consuming less than what is currently being produced, and then using part of that unconsumed physical goods to create new buildings, place productive tools and machinery inside those new buildings, and only then produce new goods. Well, now, the root of good economic thinking is, when it starts, when applied to a basic barter economy, nothing at all fundamentally changes when that economy switches over to an indirect exchange with the introduction of money, except that in a money economy, savings, which were real goods in the barter economy, are now held in the form of money. Well, put another way, you people out there that have money in the bank, you don't have sacks of wheat and bushels of apples. You presume that these sacks of wheat and these tires and batteries and gasoline and all these things that are represented by this money that you have in the bank are out there somewhere in somebody's warehouse. Now, if the money supply is equal to the goods and services that are in the warehouse, everything's fine. But what happens if the money supply is greater than all of the goods and services that are in all the warehouses in America? What happens? Here's the answer. Get your pen and paper out here. I'll tell you what the answer is. 2%. If all the people of America took all of their money today and went down to Walmart, they'd clear all the shelves off in short order. And there's enough goods out there to supply 2% of the money demand. Put another way, there's 98% more money out there than there is goods. Now, one of these days, there's going to be a raid on the warehouse. In olden days, we used to call this a run on the bank. This run on the bank, that's where the bank has lent out way more than it actually has in deposits, way more than it actually has in cash back there in the vault. But now, worldwide, not just here in the United States, all you people over in China, wake up. Japan, pay attention, smell the coffee here. If you take all the goods in the world and divided them out with all the money that's available to buy all of those goods, you can only get 2% of the goods with all the money you got, because that's all the goods that are out there. Now, the worst part of this story is that the factories are closing. We're not replacing the goods. And the people are unemployed, but they're still consuming the goods. And when is this going to hit? June, that's next month. Or as I speak, about 10 days. Maybe July. Maybe as late as August. As the world economy is contracting at the rate of 22%, we're also contracting. Our factories are contracting. Now get this number, write it down. Steel production worldwide has been cut by 50%. So the steel producers are expecting the world's economy to produce one half of what it produced in the past. Boys and girls, we're adding population to the world at the rate of 100 million people a year. 100 million people a year. It would seem like to me that we need to add capacity. We need to add more apple orchards. We need to plant more apple trees. But instead of doing that, we're ripping out half of them. Kids, can you see where this is leading us? Now, the monetary authorities, our government authorities, are telling us, go on back to the stateroom. Everything's going to be fine. We got everything under control. This is just a minor recession, a little burp in the baby's belly, and it's going to be out shortly. Nothing to worry about. Boys and girls, that's not what economic realities tell us. When you cut your steel production by half, you're saying, in effect, we expect that economic activity is going to be cut in half, that production is going to be cut in half, we're going to produce half as much. And I know somebody's going to say, well, all we've got to do is start the steel mills again. That's true. all of the laborers are still there and all of the factories are still there. What we have is a disconnect between the worker working in the factory. And that's because the paper money economy sent a lot of false signals out there to us, disrupted things, and bankrupted itself. That's what's happened. And I suspect that the powers that be have done this intentionally because it's now time for the chaos to envelop and the new world order to take shape. Now, in addition to this, they intend to reduce the Earth's population by 90%. Another little complicating factor in here for boys and girls like us down here at the bottom of the pond. They also have in mind that there's too many useless eaters out here and we need to reduce the Earth's population. And that would sound kind of like nuclear bomb war and Revelation chapter 6, doesn't it? Now, let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. 4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you would like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're taking a look at economic reality. And where we were just before the break is that steel production worldwide has been cut in half. And what that signals then is a cutback in total industrial and economic production of 50%. Boys and girls, that is drastic, dramatic, unheard of in history. To simply cut back economic production by 50% is suicide. It's insane. It can't happen. It's unsustainable. It ain't gonna work. Well, without having some drastic repercussions, you know, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So, you know, let's just picture this. Let's cut your standard of living by 50%. Let's just take your paycheck and cut it in half. Is that going to have an impact on how much you eat and what you eat? About where you live and what kind of conditions you live in? about your transportation and the kind of car that you're driving. I mean, that's where the reality is. That's where the real numbers are. Now your government officials are telling you, just stick with us and we're going to print more money. At the same time, the steel mills say we're going to put out half as much steel. Well, okay. You're going to have a lot more money out there, but you're going to have half as much steel. So that's going to double the price of steel right there, coupled with, well, how much money are you going to print? Well, already we've tripled the money supply. Well, if you triple the money supply and you cut production by half, what's that tell you the ultimate price is going to be for that ton of steel? Isn't that five times higher? I mean, I'm not a mathematical whiz here, but it looks like to me that if steel was selling for $500 a ton, it's going to go up to $2,500 a ton very shortly. Well, if that's the case, and you've got the $2,500, there's no problem. What do the rest of us do down here when we don't have the $2,500? Well, then that means we're going to have a lot less steel to use, aren't we? And steel now is a fundamental in manufacturing. I mean, everything's made out of steel. Cans that you put food in are made out of steel. Somebody's going to say, oh my God, well, we use aluminum cans. Well, okay. I don't know where aluminum production is, but I would guess, not having seen the numbers, that the people that are producing aluminum are probably just about cutting their production in half. It looks like there's an economic contraction of about 50% coming. Now, if you're going to contract the economy by 50%, isn't that going to put about 50% of the people out of work? I mean, that's just, if the fundamental, the basic building blocks of manufacturing in an economy is steel and you cut it back by half, doesn't that cut the economy back by half? And if you cut the economy by half, doesn't that create 50% or half unemployed? Those are what the numbers tell us. Is that where we're at now? No. We're only at 20% unemployed. But we're headed to 50. Now, in Argentina, they topped out at 62%. It isn't going to come to a point where everybody's unemployed. You're not going to have 100% unemployed. That isn't going to happen. But here's what happened in Argentina. Let's suppose you're making $10 an hour, okay? And you're working away here for your $10. And unemployment starts to take off, and when it hits about 20%, there's 20 guys out of 100 that don't have a job, 80 guys have a job, 20 guys don't. So the 20 guys that don't have a job come over to the employer and say, we will work for $8 an hour. So what does that do to the wages of the 80 guys that are working? It cuts the wages of everybody down to $8. And that's because that's the new market bottom for wages. That's because there's a large segment of the population out here, unemployed, that's willing to work for $8. $8 is better than nothing. And so it's $10 or nothing, so we'll work for $8. Okay, so now 20% of these guys take the jobs of the 20% that are there. All right, so now all we have is a change in employed and unemployed. But now the wage rate is $8, and you still have 20% that are unemployed. So now the 20% that are unemployed come to the same employer and say, we'll work for $6. Now what does that do? Well, that lowers the wage scale now down to $6. You see, as long as you have this unemployed group that are out here bargaining in the marketplace, then the wages are going to constantly be bargained down. That's deflation. All right, well, deflation occurs when you've got a shortage, okay? And you have a shortage of jobs, and so you're bidding the shortage of jobs cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, aren't you? And that's the economic reality of it. Now, when the unemployment rate gets to be 30, 40, 50, 60%, then the speed with which this process occurs moves up rapidly. And then finally, you'll get to a least common denominator. When we're all working for the wages of a Chinese coolie, well, then that's where the bottom is. And that's where we're headed. Now, here in America, we didn't need to do this. You see, we didn't need globalization and free trade. The Chinese needed it. The Japanese needed it. But we didn't. I mean, we were the guys that were buying. And as a result, we have exported 10 million jobs over the last 10 years overseas. 10 million jobs are gone. It's probably double that, but 10 million is what they admit to. All right, now, let's take a look at the next paragraph. So what are our modern economists and politicians fundamentally deluded about? Our politicians and economists have been deluded by their assumption that by increasing the quantity of paper money and credit money in current circulation, that they can conjure real physical savings out of thin air with no reduction in consumption. Boys and girls, this is madness. We are ruled by madmen in high office. I don't think these people are mad at all. I think these people know full well what they're doing. And they're carrying it out. Now, what they're telling us is madness. If you believe that you can cut your production by 50% and then double your paper money in circulation and bring about prosperity, you've lost touch with reality. Your mind is gone. All that's going to do is produce shortages, and shortages produce poverty, and poverty produces death. This isn't good at all. Now, this is what's coming. This is where the real economic reality is. Production worldwide is being cut in half at the same time your money supply is being doubled and tripled. Now, when this does not work, then your monetary authorities will say, the problem is we didn't put out enough money. You see, instead of doubling or tripling the money supply, we should have quadrupled or sextupled it. And that's what they'll do as a follow-up. Then, when that happens, then the industrial production will be cut in half again. Why will it be cut in half? Because you've got more and more people consuming more and more goods. At the same time, you've got more and more money coming into the marketplace and bidding the price up. It's the exact opposite to what you really need to do. What you need to do is to stop your consumption, slow your consumption down, and save more so that you'll have more real investment capital to put into more new machinery, more new factories, and more new apple orchards. Boys and girls, we need to plant more apple trees. And we need to stop tearing out the apple trees that we've already got there. And that's what this monetary policy is doing. I know it sounds good, and the Secretary of the Treasury, nice guy, gets on TV every night, Katie Couric, and says, hey, we're just working real hard, going back to your stateroom, everything's going to be fine. And then I pick up the privateer. By the way, let me give you that name and number here for the privateer again. And we're taking this from William A.M. Buckler. And he writes a newsletter called The Privateer. And I recommend his newsletter highly. It's about $180 a year. Annual, 25 issues. Australian, $180. Last time I looked at an Australian dollar, it was worth about 80% of U.S. money. So if we took 180 times 0.80, it'd be about $150 in round numbers in U.S. money. Well worth the money if you can get somebody that tells you where reality is located. And this guy does that William A. M. Buckler, P.O. Box 2004, that's 2004. Noosa Heads, Queensland, 4567, Australia. Online, they're www.the-privateer.com. An email address is capt@the-privateer.com. And their phone is 617-5471-1960. So let's go backwards again. Here's their phone number. 617-5471-1960. The email address is capt@the-privateer.com. And their email address is www.the-privateer.com. $180 Australian a year, about $150 U.S. You can subscribe at our website, www.the-privateer.com/sub.html. And this guy's name again, William A. M. Buckler, P.O. Box 2004, Noosa Heads, two words, Noosa, N-O-O-S-A, H-E-A-D-S, Queensland, 4567, Australia. Published twice a month. All right, going on. He says, in reality, whether we live in a barter or direct exchange economy or a money or indirect exchange economy, real physical savings must precede renewed investment in capital goods, the center ground of true capitalism. Money can be created out of paper or, in the case of credit money, out of thin air. Real capital cannot. I'm going to underline that. Real capital cannot be created out of thin air. Real apple trees do not come out of thin air. They come from labor. To equate money with capital leads to capital consumption, a real physical contraction in a nation's total stock of capital. Capital consumption can always be observed in the form of aging factories and acres of factories already shut down. The privateer holds forward as real evidence for this the current state of the entire U.S. manufacturing sector. It is this attempt to equate money with capital or real wealth which dooms the Obama administration's attempt to kickstart or to stimulate the failing U.S. economy with its gargantuan budget deficits and the Federal Reserve System's zero interest rate policy and gargantuan money infusion into the banking system. None of this will increase savings. None of this will work. All right, now take a look. 1960, America's economic engine was about 60% industrial capacity. Today, it is down to 9%. And boys and girls, we have acres and acres of closed, empty, rusting factories all over America that testify to the failure of this 10 plank to the Communist Manifesto formula that we've been following in this country since 1933. It sounded good. It looked good. And we wanted to buy it, and we did. All right, but now we've got the economic consequences of it. You've lost your manufacturing base. It's gone. You've lost 10 million jobs. They are gone. Your steel mills have now shut down 50% of their capacity. It is gone. Wake up here. Smell some coffee. Your unemployment rate is 19.2%. That's where the real number is. But it's worse than that. The economic collapse is not reaching the bottom. It is in free fall. It has been for the past 16 months, and it continues so. And now your government, in its desperation, is going to seize all of the savings of America. That's your 401ks. Now that's what's coming. I don't know if it's coming this year or next year, but it's coming. It's been done before in Brazil. And it will be done here in America because desperate people do desperate things. And the American economy is in desperate straits, and your political establishment is in desperate mode. Now, we can't plant, and that's because we ate all of the seed corns. Boys and girls, the last thing that you ever want to do is to eat your seed. You need that to grow your food. And once you've eaten your seed corn, you're dead. Now, the U.S. economy today is, in industrial terms, like a once very prosperous farmer. In an area in which the farmers were persuaded by mountebanks and their other fakers that the road to even greater prosperity was to consume the entire present farm output today and then borrow more worldwide and consume that too. A point is now near where the U.S. cannot plant in industrial terms. It has consumed its seed. It has consumed all of its capital. So America now is bankrupt. I mean, you know, if you had, let's suppose that you were an heir and you inherited $100,000. You now have $100,000 to invest. How do you want to invest your money? Well, should you invest it in planting new apple trees and building up your apple orchard? Or should you take your $100,000 and go on a trip to Europe and spend your money on a princess cruise? So, we went out and spent our money on a princess cruise and a trip to Europe. Now our $100,000 is gone. We have no investment capital. But we still have our apple orchard. So somebody says, well, listen, why don't you just consume your apple orchard? So we did. Now we have consumed our apple orchard. Now we have no investment capital, and we have no apple orchard. And now we are about to go hungry. And now your president says, well, what we need to do is just print a lot more money and pretend. Huh? Huh? I say it's time to wake up and smell the coffee here. Page 4. The collapse in the U.S. collateral foundation. U.S. home prices dropped the most on record in the first quarter of 2009 from a year earlier. It was led by California and Florida as banks sold foreclosed properties. The median price over the quarter fell by 14% to $169,000. The U.S. National Association of Realtors said on May 12th, the U.S. jobless rate rose to 8.9%, its highest in more than 25 years. The Labor Department reported on May 9th. As the huge U.S. housing market is collapsing under its lenders, with market prices falling below the loans leaning against them, a steep wall lies straight ahead. The U.S. housing market is going to start hitting it in June and July. This wall is the resetting of the super low teaser mortgage rates swung into the field about 3 years ago as the U.S. housing market went into its last upward spasm. They're called the Alt-A and the low or no doc mortgages, which are set to have their interest rates double, triple, or go even higher over the second half of this year, with so many houses in the U.S. already below water, with more owing on the mortgage than the current market value of the house. How, then, are many Americans going to be able to refinance these loans? Here's an example. A $200,000 mortgage leans against a house valued at $165,000. What still sane lender would make such a loan? It is no longer a question of whether the American borrower will be able or willing to service the approaching much higher mortgage payments. It is a financial question of whether many of these earlier short-term mortgage loans can be rolled over at all. Further, what still sane borrower would sign up for a loan of $200,000 on a property which is now valued at $165,000 or less? Well, the Federal Reserve recently said that there were $12.1 trillion in U.S. mortgages. Other estimates go to as high as $14.1 trillion, and it's estimated that 30 to 35% of those are underwater right now, regardless of the interest rate. Boys and girls, that little problem hasn't hit the economy yet, but it's coming, and it starts next month, or as I speak, about 10 days from today. That's when it begins. And it's going to take 3 years for that problem to unravel. And then there's the commercial real estate market, and the credit card debt, and the balance of payments problem. They haven't hit yet. They're starting to, but they haven't hit with full force. To give you an illustration of this balance of payments problem, we import about $800 billion a year, and we export $200 billion a year. What that says is that we're buying $600 billion more than we're paying for. That means that somebody is taking $600 billion a year in IOUs. Since America is already bankrupt, how long will these people continue to take our worthless IOUs now that everybody in the world knows that they're never going to get paid back? How long will that continue? I don't know. But I do know this. It ain't going to last forever. So that roughly leaves U.S. $4 trillion in mortgages that are exposed. This entire U.S. financial system only has about $1.4 trillion in capital. It is horribly exposed. Recent stress tests, to the contrary, notwithstanding, to a new wave of capital losses, this is what happens in a credit money system when the collateral foundation crashes out from under the financial system. Shrink that collateral foundation far enough, and the banking and the financial system becomes insolvent. You know, that is the real United States stress test. That's already happened, boys and girls. We're already bankrupt. All right, this is The Privateer. Remember, it's published by William A.M. Buckler. Online, it's www.the-privateer.com. And their phone number is 617-5471-1960. And with that, I'm about out of time again. So let me remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Hey, time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.